Everyone, welcome to the Villa Together podcast. And today I'm recording a special episode as I've got a very, very special guest with me, which is Mr. Nigel Boyle. You may recognise him. He's got one of those faces. He starred in Line of Duty. He's also been in The Inbetweeners, and you will have seen him on lots of stuff on TV. But the main reason he's here today is because he's a big Aston Villa fan. So, Mr. Boyle, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nice one. Thanks for coming on. as we were just saying, I've spoken to, obviously, through doing this, spoken to a number of Villa fans from all around the world, in all fairness. So obviously, a big part of us kind of talking today is to find out more about you and Aston Villa. So how long have you kind of supported Aston Villa, and what got you into supporting Aston Villa?
Probably I've been supporting them for about 30 years now. I'm 43 now. I grew up in a household that wasn't really mad into football. Both my parents are Irish immigrants. They came over in the 50s and all they wanted to do was work. So we grew up in pubs. My dad ran pubs. Mum and dad ran pubs and stuff. And he wasn't really mad into football, but I did have two brothers that were, and they were Blues fans. I was born in Moseley, grew up in Bartley Green. The latest pub I can remember was in Bartley Green. So it was a kind of mixed area, but there was probably a bigger sway for Birmingham fans. So in all honesty, the first ground I ever went to was St Andrews. So my brother took me down once when I was about seven, I think. But then my dad got a different job. He took over an Irish club in Perry Bar called St Teresa's, which was by the One Stop. So as you know, if you know Birmingham, then you know that it's right at the top of Aston Lane. Yeah. And it was a 20-minute walk to Villa Park. So when I started hanging around Perry Bar when I was about 10, 11, and, you know, I got into groups of lads and that who were Villa fans and stuff. And I started secondary school. So started to get really into football then. And I went down to the Villa and never looked back. Going,
there you go. I know you talk about obviously different areas of Birmingham and stuff like that. I used to work in Perry Bar, and in all fairness, it probably is closer to obviously certainly Aston Villa, but you probably got the Hawthorns probably closer there than St Andrews, possibly.
I suppose it depends on which Perry Bar, you mean?
Yeah,
probably. Would the Hawthorns be? I don't think so. I think, well, so obviously Villa Park would be the nearest ground. Then St Andrews, would have thought.
I don't know.
But interestingly enough, I went to school in Wensbury, so most of the kids there supported Albion anyway. So there was one or two Villa fans from Great Bar, but there was a big catchment area in Sandwell. So, and I actually, we moved to West Brom at that time, so I actually lived in West Brom from the age of about 11 to about 18. I was working in a pub in Wensbury, and the manager was a friend of my dad's, and his daughter worked in the ticket office at Villa Park. Sharon McCullough, her name was, and he used to get us tickets. So the very first time we went to Villa Park, I was sat in the director's box. Because we got these tickets, and the people that didn't have the that were supposed to sit in the director's box didn't turn up, so we had their tickets, and I sat behind Nigel Kennedy, and we played Derby. I think it was 2-0 we won, so managed to get my program signed by all the players and stuff, and then it was a no brainer. Then I wanted to go every week, but obviously it wasn't always going to be in the director's box. And then when I became a teenager, I got a season ticket then for the Holt End. And started going there, standing up at the back on the left side.
Yeah, it's different. excuse me, different kind of experience, isn't it? To, I suppose, being like director's box and meeting the players and stuff like that is kind of, I suppose, at a young age as well. It's a, you know, it's a great memory, and obviously then as well, to experience watching Villa in the Holt End is a completely different kind of memory. But also another one that's going to kind of stick with you. And it also, because I think a lot of fans, I know people will say clubs they go to and where they sit and all that kind of stuff. We'll talk about, these stands and stuff like that. I don't think a lot of fans really appreciate how like how good the atmosphere is in the Holt End. It's kind of, it just takes you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as you get older, you know, you want to do stuff with your friends as opposed to go down with your family and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I wanted to go down to the Holt End with my friends. And in them days, we used to get the football tops and put them over a jumper. Do you remember? Yeah. Like, you know, because it was so cold and stuff. But you'd get down to the Holt End at about 1:30 because you wanted to get your plot up, because in them days there was no seats. So it was all standing. So you wanted to get your plot up right towards the back of the left side. Usually in front of a bar or just behind a bar. So you'd lean on the bar, get your program. I was smoking cigarettes then and trying to buy alcohol. So I think we could get them little bottles of Sol. Was it Sol or Skull? Yeah. Little plastic bottles. And we'd bring them up. You could drink them in the Holt End. Certainly before kickoff, they might have stopped it. I can't remember, but it was a kind of whole afternoon thing because you'd get there so early. And you'd read your program, and you know you're meeting up with your friends and stuff, and the atmosphere built slowly and slowly and slowly, and you know, by the time kickoff was there, you were pumped, ready for it.
Yeah, it's a different kind of ball game. The experience of being inside a football stadium. What about your kind of your memories of supporting Aston Villa? What would you say your fondest memory of watching Aston Villa play is?
It was always good to beat Blues, but during those days we didn't have a really good record against Birmingham City. I mean, I remember when the famous game where Dion Dublin headbutted Robbie Savage and the Enkelman goal and stuff like that. I was in the Trinity for that, in the upper Trinity, the very top tier. I remember I was sat with my sister. She wanted to go down, so we went down. It was just horrendous, but I guess fondest memories are watching people like Paul McGrath and Dwight York and, you know, Dalen Atkinson and Hugo Ekio, bless him, and, you know, all those kind of players, Nigel Spink and Steve Staunton and Kevin Richardson and Sean Till, you know, such good players, Ray Houghton, you know, Andy Townsend. It was just probably my favourite memory was the Coca-Cola Cup, beating United 3-1 in the Coca-Cola Cup.
Yeah,
you know, all them years ago at Wembley, in the old Wembley. So I'm quite proud to say I've been to both Wembleys. But yeah, it was always good to go down and get a win.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Wembley a number of times, obviously quite recently. I think I've only seen us win there once, which obviously would have been the playoff final where we went up. Because obviously before that, you got the playoff final against Fulham. Saw us at Wembley when we lost against United, the cup final, Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final.
Arsenal.
Yeah, Arsenal when we got battered. It's just, so my memories of, I never went to the old Wembley, but my memories of the new Wembley, certainly going as a Villa fan, you know, pretty poor. Not you kind of have a good day, but in terms of the result, it's kind of, obviously, it's a kind of all-day thing, isn't it, when you're going out to Wembley. So you have a great day.
That's a massive thing, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's tarnished by your team losing, which is, you know, it's the reason you go there. But it's a great day out, isn't it?
Well, it feels like almost our second home at the moment. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's, you know, we've been there so often. Obviously, we were there in March as well, February, March this year, obviously for the Carabao Cup final, EFL Cup final, whatever they call it these days. So again, I mean, it's like a lot of Villa fans said at the time, that cup final, it's just a great day out, as usual, as we've had some really great day out recently, but the result kind of tarnishes it slightly. But yeah, like you say, it is like a second home, which is great, because there are fans of clubs that probably haven't even seen their team at Wembley once.
Yeah.
So, you know, so for us Villa fans to have been able to kind of go that regularly recently is pretty good. So in terms of going to watch Aston Villa, going to Villa Park, what would your kind of typical match day experience be?
Well, it's different now because I live in London, so but I've still got my season ticket for the Holt End. So I don't get to every game, but what I do is try and get to some away games. So any games that are in London. So anyone who comes up from the Championship to the Premiership or whatever, you know, I'm always looking at who's what London teams there are, because they're like home games for me. And I get a lot of, it's much easier to get clearance to go to one of those from the missus than it is to go all the way up to Birmingham. But a typical day would be get up early. If it's a 3 o'clock kickoff, I'd get up early and try and get up to Birmingham as soon as possible for, say, lunchtime. And we meet a lot of lads on the train. So we're all kind of, the lads I kind of tend to go with, we're all based in London, but one of the lads has moved up to near Milton Keynes now. So we'd pick him up on the train on the way up. And I think the train journey is probably the best because, you know, you're having a chat about the game, having a few beers, something to eat, and maybe a few cheeky bets, first goal scorer and all that kind of thing. And then we'd get to, normally go to the Hen and Chickens on Constitution Hill, the curry pub, and get something from there. Or sometimes we just go straight to the ground. I like going to the Holt Suite. I love the fact that they've done the Holt Suite for the fans, because it's such a really good kind of place to get some good food and just sit down and have a chat. It's rather than going to a packed pub and trying to get served and stuff. I think the Holt Suite's a really, really good thing. Yeah, and it's great then that they open it, you know, for the lower Holt, they open it at half time, so you can always get served. You know, because all you want to do at half time is get a drink, don't you, or something to eat, or, you know.
Yeah, but you end up queuing, and then by the time you got served, you missed the start of the second half.
Yeah, it's terrible. I've got mates who sit in the Witten, and it's a nightmare for them because the concourses are so small.
Yeah,
the queues are just horrendous, and they, you know, it's not even a thing for them. They don't even bother at half time.
Yeah. No, I'm the same. I usually just sit there and read my program for a bit because I can never get signal to text or anything like that. So I just sit there, read program for a bit, because I know if I go down there, I'll end up getting stuck. And then before you know it, I'll miss the first 5 minutes. And I hate missing any part of the game. It's like a
me too. I get really stressed out if I'm heading up to the ground and it's late and I know I'm going to miss kickoff. I don't know why I get really stressed out. And I'm the same when I'm trying to get myself set up to watch a game at home or to get the stream up or to get, to get it on Sky Sports. If I'm hurrying, I'm getting really stressed out. I just want the game and a beer or a bag of crisps or whatever and to just watch it. But so then we'd probably watch the game. Sometimes I go to the pre-match events if there's something going on that I get invited to. I might go to one of them. Then watch a game, and then we'll head either back to the pub for a quick pint before we get the train, or, you know, if we're running short of time, we'll go straight and get the train, get a bit of a carry out for the journey back, and away we go.
Yep. So what about now? Because obviously it's kind of changed. Obviously it's changed for everyone now, hasn't it? So what would your typical match day experience be now? Obviously, you know, COVID's kind of just affected it for everyone. I mean, is there any kind of anything you do now where to try and get as much out of it as you can from home?
Yeah. So when the rules are a bit more relaxed, I'd get a mate round, or, you know, go to another mate's for dinner, and then we'd watch the game and stuff like that. But it's just all a bit tricky now. I don't think you can't do that now, can you? You kind of, at the current rules, you can't have anyone in your house.
Depends where you live and what tier it's in.
That's it. It's all a bit kind of moody. Yeah. And also, it's really impossible to plan because the kickoff times are all over the place now. So I think Sky have finally got what they wanted. You know, I think they've been trying to do this for years now. I think if they had their way, they'd have games kicking off at all times every single day.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed it during lockdown because it felt like that you could watch every game. But now it's kind of like you have to pay for the games that aren't on Sky, which is, I mean, particularly for us, I think 4 games in a row for us are pay-per-view. So, you know, it's best part of £60 on top of whatever else you pay.
Yeah, it's really annoying that is. And, you know, I'm all up for putting money back into the club. And they're trying to say that the clubs get all of that money, but I'm not convinced, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
See, and I'm a bit annoyed at Villa for not doing something to counteract that. In, you know, streaming it on Villa TV for a tenner, maybe that would have been a good idea to you know. But obviously they don't want to lose their relationship with Sky. So, but I think a Sunday night kickoff at 7:15 and stuff like that. It's just, I mean, and this Sunday it's 12:00. You know, it's difficult when you've got kids in the house.
Yeah. No, I agree. Obviously, exactly the same. The kind of kickoff times being all over the place. If it's an evening game, you know, 7:45, 8 PM is fine. But then these 7:15 kickoffs, you know, they're rubbish times if you've got kids, because it's kind of like peak bedtime.
I mean, that's the business end of the day for us. You know what I mean?
It's yeah.
Bed, in the bath, story time, pajamas. You know, and it's all cutting into that time.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exact same. Yeah. It's frustrating because I think, you know, you mentioned that about, you know, potentially streaming it on you know, Villa TV and stuff like that. I think knowing the Villa fans are happy to spend money and buy tops whenever they come out. You know, they could release a home top and then release the same top but in a slightly different colour for, you know, away kit or third kit. And people would buy it because they love buying stuff. But it just feels like giving this extra money to Sky, it just doesn't feel right, because they, like you said, it does. They say it goes to the clubs, which we'd be fine about. But I think because it would be, say, branded slightly, if it was done to Villa TV or AV TV, however it is, I think Villa fans would just lap it up. Tenner, £9.99, whatever it is. And more people would pay for it. Because I think, obviously, there's a lot of people kind of boycotting it at the moment, isn't there?
Well, 15 quid. I mean, you can go and watch a match live in Germany for that.
Yeah.
And have a really good match day experience. High quality football in the Bundesliga. Yeah. You can have a beer, sit down, or I think they've got safe standing at the Allianz Arena now, have they? Am I making that up? I'm pretty sure they've got safe standing somewhere or some kind of thing. But yeah. You know, you can have a beer. It's civilized. You know, for 15, 20 quid, and now you've got to pay that to watch it on the. I think it's horrendous, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, especially like because of the four games in a row for us. That 60 quid, it adds up, doesn't it? Especially when you look at the money you spend, and then, you know.
And it's also a lesser quality experience than it would have been if the fans were in the stadium. So we're watching an empty stadium with piped on a fan noise and stuff for 15 quid for 90 minutes. I think it's horrendous, really. It's, you know, it's just a money ball that just keeps going, isn't it? I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think we should have to, in these circumstances, I don't think we should have to pay to watch it.
Certainly don't
think we should be paying 15 quid to watch it.
No, I totally agree. I think a lot of people have kind of said about either £9.99 or possibly, you know, £5 or something. I think people would lap it up then if it was a lot cheaper. It
it could be like £9.99, but if you buy a package of all the matches... month, it works out at like 6 quid a game or something. I don't know. Like, it's just like 15 quid, and that's it. And you can only do it. You can only do it on Sky. Then you got to download the Sky Go app and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think the thing is that we're in a position where fans can't go to the games, so it effectively is the only way that people can watch the games.
They've got them by the curlies, aren't they? And they know people will pay it. They know people, and they know enough people will pay it to make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
So you can boycott it all you want, but there'll always be the fans that'll pay. I mean, I'm guilty. I paid for the first game.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to watch it, but I didn't pay for the second one because I, you know, and I'm glad I didn't pay for to watch us get beat by Leeds 3-0. But you know, it's like when does it stop? You know,
exactly.
And the more people that pay it, the more they're going to charge for it.
Yeah, because then they'll look at it and they'll say it's kind of reason to keep doing it. People are paying for it, so we'll keep doing it. It's frustrating, but then again, same time, because you know, people like me and you, we want to watch the game. We don't want to miss our team. So there will be times you sit there, you think, oh, I've got to watch it, especially when you're in a bit of a rush and you kind of, you know, you sit down, you put it on, and you're like, yeah, I'm gonna have to pay for it, get it on, and it kind of. It just gets people because there's no other alternative. You can't, you know, it's not a case of people go to the game. We literally can't do that now. So it's just frustrating. And I think like what you said, it's not the games at the moment. Yes, okay, we all watch them. But it's not like games when the season's on and you can feel the atmosphere, you know, with the crowd noise. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's just a bit of rubbish noise that you can tell and usually out of sync, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's less kind of quality for the people watching. So to charge those prices, it's just ridiculous. They're just kind of taking advantage, aren't they? The kind of whole situation.
Yeah, it's taking a liberty, but, you know, hopefully they'll come back onto the mainstream kind of Sky channels and not pay-per-view.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. But it's still one of them, isn't it, with Sky and BT, kind of that top four, top six kind of bias in terms of those are the guys that are going to be on TV more than us guys. And obviously at the moment, we're kind of not on Sky Sports 1 or 2 or whatever, Sky Sports Premier League. We're having to get it on box office. So it's kind of frustrating, but it's the situation we're in at the moment, aren't we? So, you know, what can we do?
You've just got to suck it and see, mate.
So obviously because the football is, we can't go to the games and things like that. Just kind of think of a bit of like nostalgia. You've mentioned a lot of players that you enjoyed watching over the years. Who would you say either like your kind of favourite player was or your favourite player to watch has been over the years?
So historically, it's always been God, Paul McGrath, who sat behind you there.
He's there.
He was just something special that I think all Aston Villa fans, no matter who you are, would agree with. And there was the Irish connection as well, because he was Irish. My parents were Irish. I grew up watching Ireland and supporting Ireland in the World Cups and stuff. But I also play centre back, so watching Paul McGrath back again and with the effortless kind of skill that he used to just do those little back heels and, you know, just get his foot in at the right time and not run around like a maniac and stuff. He was just so composed, and it's just a joy to watch, and I'm just really happy that we had him for as long as we did. But nowadays, Jack Grealish is rapidly becoming my favourite player of all time.
Yeah.
And I don't know how credible that is to say that when someone's, you know, only been really starting for us for a few years, but he's just something special, like Paul McGrath was in a different way. And he's just a joy to watch, and I just wish him all the best for his career, whatever he does. But I'm just so glad and happy that he's signed that new contract, which is arguably the signing of the window for me, getting him to locking him down for five years.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. What are your kind of thoughts about our business that we've done in the window and how we've started the season so far?
It's been arguably one of the best windows we've had in recent times, I think. And the stats speak for themselves. The way we've started the window, I think it's been brilliant. The only thing that worries me is if we get any injuries, I think we're going to be in big trouble. Particularly if anything happens to Ollie Watkins. I know he hasn't scored in the last couple of games, but I think we're relying on him now, because it's such a joy to have a proper striker who knows where the net is.
Yeah,
in your team, who's prolific. But if you know, God forbid, if there was an injury that took him out for the season, I think we'd really struggle.
Yeah, I think we've got
coming back, but I think he's just going to take time to get up to speed.
Yeah,
and find his form. Keenan Davis, as we all know, is a really good player, but he's not prolific enough for what we need. And if we're going to play that system where there's a lone striker with as part of a three, if you like, but he's quite isolated at times as well. If we're going to play that system, you need someone that knows where the onion bag is and who can hit it on a regular basis, at least hit the target. But, you know, it's a little bit worrying how isolated Ollie Watkins was against the Leeds game.
Yeah.
I think that the stat at half-time was that he touched the ball six times. You know, and that's never a good sign. When I remember them dropping stats like that when Gabby was playing, I think he touched the ball three times or something by half time, and it was always a bit of a worry.
Yeah, I think that I can't think who it was we played that game. Might have been someone, Liverpool or Spurs. I think it was Spurs, and Gabby touched the game for the kickoff, and then the other two times were the two goals we conceded. For the next two kickoffs after that, but yeah, it's a tough one, I think, with Watkins, because I think with strikers, we've been kind of very up and down over the years, haven't we? It's like we'll have a season with a good striker.
Yeah.
In the next season, we kind of haven't been so lucky. And I feel like with Watkins, he's got a bit of everything. And obviously, he knows where the net is. He's scored a lot of goals. Obviously, got a great hat-trick against Liverpool. But we need to try and get him involved in a bit more. I suppose the last two games, he hasn't scored in, but they've been very... The Leicester game was on a bit of a knife edge, very tight game. And the Leeds game was tough for him because obviously second half, it was even at half time, but second half, they just blew us away. So obviously he's not going to be touching the ball a lot, but I agree with you on that one, because if he got injured, you know, Davis would come in, and he's a decent player. Obviously he holds up the ball well, but you know, I think he could probably play for, you know, 10, 15 years and probably wouldn't get 10 goals. You know, doesn't seem like a natural goal scorer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've only got to look at what happened to us last year when the spine of our team got injured badly. Tom Heaton, John McGinn, Wesley. Did Tyrone Mings get injured at the same time? I can't remember.
Yeah, he was out for about a month.
Yeah. So the spine and arguably our best players were out, most of them, for the whole season. So it's no wonder we struggled and, you know, nearly went down. But you've got to have strength in depth, and I think we know that. So I was disappointed, even though I thought it was one of the best windows we've had in recent times. I think, you know, the signings we made, the Arsenal keeper Martinez is just a brilliant signing, and my wife's a Goonie as well, so she was really gutted when that happened. She said, "No," I said, "he's any good?" And she's like, "He's amazing. He's brilliant. You know, you've got a real steal there. You know, they're great players. And Matty Cash, I think he's brilliant. I think he's a real signer. I think he's gonna get better as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm excited for Traore. I want to see more of him, and I can honestly see Trez losing his place to him eventually, even though Trez deserves to play and start. But I think Traore is a step up in that position.
Yeah, I agree. I think we haven't seen a massive amount of Traore, but the few games that he has played in the cup, he does look like that extra level above. He's got a bit of something else. I think with Trezeguet, what he probably lacks in kind of quality on the ball and technical ability, he does make up for it in terms of his work ethic.
Yeah, his work rate's outstanding. It's brilliant. But I think Matty Cash was left it really exposed in the Leeds game.
Yeah,
and that's something that's got to be addressed. If you're gonna be a hard worker, like in playing that position, and play the way we do, he's got to get back and cover.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was a tough one against Leeds, but yeah, I think
they were great. I mean, let's not take anything away from Leeds. They were from the kickoff. The pressing that they were doing was just outstanding. And like, I'm a big believer in pressing from the front and defending from the front. Massive believer in that. And Villa don't often do that. Don't always. They're famous for giving teams time on the ball. And whenever we haven't, whenever we've pressed high and from the front, we've generally won games, and we tend to play well. So I don't know what that's all about. And people are saying that Leeds are the fittest team in the league. I just don't get that. Like, surely every team, 20 teams, should be the fittest teams in the league. You know, there's no excuse for not being as fit as another team. I just really do not get that.
Yeah.
You know, fitness. I think it's something we've always had a problem with, because I've heard, you know, apparently when Steve Bruce first came here, he said fitness is a big issue. How the hell in these times can fitness be an issue? You know, okay, one thing, there's injuries affecting fitness, that's one thing, but general athletic fitness should never be an issue in a Premiership football team ever.
Yeah, especially at that level, because a big part of people, the difference between making it and not making it, obviously there's the technical side of things, but also, you know, players have got to be fit, and they've got to have that athletic ability about it. So to be at that level and for someone to say that fitness is an issue, it's an odd one. But I think
if you're someone like Conor Hourihan, who's always, you know, on the fringe and you know, 50-50 whether he's going to start a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So if you're Conor Hourihan, what do you do? If I was Conor Hourihan, I'd be like, right, I'm going to get myself super fit, unbelievably fit.
Yeah.
And force my way, because that's the only thing in your power to help force your way into a team, isn't it? If you work on your fitness. But I just don't get, like, how people can say Leeds are a fitter team than us. How the bloody hell does that work? You know, how can we not be as fit as them? We've got top class fitness coaches. You know, we're all in the Premiership. It's the top level of football. don't get it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's always one I've thought of, and they say about Leeds, and you think, well, you know, surely, you know, other, especially, you know, they say the top end, the likes of Liverpool, Man City, Man United, you know, and I agree, everyone in the Premier League, the facilities they've got, the quality of coaches, everything, these guys should be peak physical condition and as fit as everyone.
Yeah.
You know, and in quality shines through. So it was a frustrating one. I think, I don't know, I felt like we've been a bit fitter this season, but it is frustrating, isn't it, when you kind of, you know, when you hear these kind of things that people say about other teams, especially against Leeds, and you kind of think, you know, come on, guys, this should be, like you say, everyone should be like it.
It's the minimum. It's the absolute minimum, you know, at this level, is to be, everyone should be super fit, unless you're coming back from an injury, or unless you're, you know, one of the older, more mature players who, you know, who's finishing, coming to the end of their career, but still good enough to start.
Yeah.
You know, like, I get that some teams might be faster and younger. That's kind of different, but everyone should be fit. Everyone should be super fit.
Yeah, it's almost like you can't, you know, teams with different budgets and things like that, the quality of the teams then will be always be different. But then if you ensure that the fitness of a team is as good as it can be, that's somewhere you can match.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So it's a bit of an odd one. So then kind of just going on this into this season, what are your kind of thoughts for the season ahead in terms of how well we may do and where we may finish?
Well, I mean, it's been a perfect start almost, apart from the Leeds result, hasn't it? It's been an absolute perfect start. No one would have foreseen this coming through, you know, these results. And I think everyone would have bitten your hand off to be in this position, this amount of games in. I think we're going to be fine. I think we're going to be okay. I just don't think, like, the Leeds result was very important, I think, to for a reality check.
Yeah.
I think we needed that. I think we needed to hang on. Let's just we're not the finished article yet. We're vastly improved on what we have been, but I don't think we're the finished article yet, and I think most people would probably agree with that. I think we've got a lot of work to do in terms of pressing and stuff like I said before, but I think we'll be fine. I think a mid-table finish would be not inconceivable.
Yeah,
and I think it would be a good stepping stone to build on for next season.
Yeah, I think especially after the way last season was, almost going down, literally leaving it to the last day. It's not just that; it's the weeks coming up to the end of the season, and you're kind of the worry that you might get relegated.
I think we've got quite a tough running, haven't we, towards the end of the season?
Yeah.
So we need to we need to really get our points on the board now.
Yeah.
But it's teams like Leeds and Southampton that are going to be real bogey teams for us. And I'm not looking forward to playing Everton and, you know, Liverpool. The next time we play them, that's going to be a different story. Yeah. Man United's always a bogey team. Like, I almost wish we'd have beat Man United 7-2 rather than Liverpool, just to get that monkey off our back.
Yeah, definitely.
But I honestly think we'll be okay. But I don't think it's going to be... I think the honeymoon period's over now.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to see another 7-2. I mean, I'd like to, but I think and teams, other teams suss you out. They work out how you're playing.
Yeah.
So, you know, but if we can maintain the team and try and avoid serious injuries and play to people's strengths, like Ollie Watkins is going to need that ball coming in.
Yeah.
You know, but I think we'll be okay.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you mentioned before about injuries. Last season, like you say, we had the spine of our team out for a good chunk of the season. That is massive in terms of how your season pans out. Yeah. So it literally, when you look at last season, there's no wonder why we were down there when a guy in Wesley, who we spent the best part of 25 million on, who kind of we almost pinned all our hopes on, in terms of getting our goals or being a big part of our play, was out for the second half of the season, big chunk of the season. The goalkeeper, who potentially would have been one of our best goalkeepers we've had for a number of years, and Tom Heaton, injured. Again, same game. big chunk of the season. John McGinn, who's been one of our best signings over the last 2 or 3 years, injured. Then when you look at the quality of the defence, like you say, Tyro Mings injured. It plays a massive part. So obviously you look at what position we're at now in terms of winning 4 from 5, which is really good. Third in the league, fantastic. But also it's kind of we've got to hope that fitness-wise that the team doesn't have any bad injuries, because squad depth potentially isn't quite there.
Yeah,
key thing to remember. But yeah, I think we should be okay. But like you say, we have got a really tough run in at the end. I think between now and the end of the year, you could probably look at all those games and say that we could potentially get something out of them. Mm-hmm. So it is a case. I think between now and the end of the year, we could realistically be looking at 25 to 30 points.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, would be massive, because then it kind of, you know, takes the pressure off for the massive amount of pressure for the second half of the season.
Yeah, how many are we on there? 11 points at the moment, isn't it?
12
points. So if we can get a few more results before Christmas and get into high double figures, then I think we'll be in good nick, really. And people, like, you know, going back to when we nearly got relegated, I think people really forget how we turned it around after lockdown.
Yep.
And if you look at the stats before lockdown, we were number one in the most shots conceded, most goals conceded, number one for like most dribbles conceded and stuff like that. Yep. Whereas after lockdown, we were number one for the fewest shots conceded, the fewest goals conceded. We completely turned it around, and people don't really get that. People think, you know, all they do, you know, fans from other teams, they just watch us on Match of the Day and think, oh God, you survived by the skin of your teeth. Well, okay, yes, we did, but we also made it happen. We orchestrated that. We completely turned it around and sorted our defence out, which was a big issue, you know. And now if we can hold on to that whatever we did there to change the defence, if we can sort our midfield out and keep scoring goals, then I think we'd be laughing.
Yeah, I think a key thing, and it, you know, probably comes into what we mentioned about Leeds, their potential, the like fitness, looking at that, because you've got with Leeds, there's a core of that team that have been together for a number of years.
Yeah.
Same with Sheffield United. And I think we haven't really had that for a while in terms of core and partnerships around the pitch. But obviously after lockdown, we had Mings and Konsa, the main two. Now in midfield, you're looking at probably McGinn, Louise, Barkley, looking at those partnerships all over the pitch, and to bring them in helps us remain solid. And I think that's a big part, especially when you look at Mings and Konsa, and probably the form of Louise coming through and being in front of those two helps us become more solid. So hopefully if we can kind of build those partnerships together, then we can kind of, I suppose, you know, build from the back, make ourselves harder to beat, which we have done. As you mentioned, the stats in terms of the complete turnaround to pre and post lockdown, then obviously it's a case of improving going forward. And I think, you know, as you mentioned before, Traore can add us another element to what Grealish and Watkins and Barkley add at the moment. So I think there's still a lot to come from us, in all fairness. I still think, even when, you know, obviously we got the win against Liverpool, got the win against Leicester, I still felt that there were other gears for us to step through.
Well, totally. And one of my biggest points was when we were during lockdown, I said, if we can get John McGinn fit, we'll stay up. And I knew that. I knew he would be the catalyst to sort that out, because he's so important for us. He's the proper engine room of our team. He is the engine room. And now we've got a problem. Well, do we play him more defensively, or do you push him forward? Because he's so good at picking out a pass, and he's so in tune with Grealish. And anyone who knows anything about football will tell you that what you want your core team of players to be playing together week in, week out. You know, if you keep changing the team, what was that? How many times did we change the defence last season? Oh my God, it was horrendous, wasn't it?
Yeah, you look at the different partnerships, whether it was two at the back, three at the back, it changed all the time, didn't it?
And I think I think Konsa's going to play for England with Mings at some point. I think he's definitely going to be a shining star for us. You know, we've got that now. We've got, you know, fullbacks who seem to know what they're doing now as well. We've got a decent midfield. It's just working out who's going to nail down those spots and which positions to play people like John McGinn and where you're going to keep him, because like, I love David Luiz, but I think he's a bit lightweight for that position.
Yeah,
I think he's been one of our best players, but I don't think he's steely enough to do that on his own against some teams that have put pressure on us.
Yeah, I think that'll be the thing in terms of McGinn dropping deeper to make it a bit harder to break down in front of the back four.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see that, especially with Barkley coming in.
Yeah.
Barkley in front of them. But I mean, interestingly, I think I was just looking at Premier League stats in general the other day. And obviously, Harry Kane's had a good season in terms of assists. I think he's got 8 assists, but I think second behind him is John McGinn.
Oh, is that right,
yeah? Yeah. So obviously he's got assists against Liverpool, against Fulham as well. And I think he got the assist for Barkley against Leicester. So as much as he probably has sat a bit deeper, he's still getting forward. But he's got the engine to do that, hasn't he?
I just love him. I just think he's a really good player. And it's his temperament as well. And one of the things that I heard Ross Barkley say that Jack was Jack really Jack signed Ross Barkley, not Villa. In my opinion, Jack went and got him, and I think we underestimate how much an influence that Jack being captain has on some of the decisions with the staff that come into Villa, or playing staff, for instance. And Ross Barkley said, well, he just said, no, you've got to come. He said it's a real tight knit thing. Everyone's playing for each other. Like, you know, that's why we stayed up. And you're going to love it here and stuff. And I certainly didn't see that coming, that Ross Barkley song. I didn't think, but I was delighted when it happened. And I thought, well, let's hope we can keep him. Let's hope he has a good year and we can keep him, because apparently our policy of only signing players on loan with the option to buy, apparently that's not in effect with the Ross Barkley signing.
Yeah, I think when you look at it, we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when the signing happened. When you look at it, you look at, okay, obviously at the moment he's not involved. He has played this season. Anyway, I think he was literally on the bench the day before he signed for us. So he was on the bench for a cup game.
Yeah.
Then he drove up to kind of sign for us and stuff like that. So he's not completely out of the picture, but obviously he hasn't been playing as much as he wants to. And that's probably the most overloaded position for Chelsea. You look at the players they've got.
Yeah.
So I think going forward, if Lampard stays, he probably is likely to then maybe, because he's had money thrown at him, if he stays, he probably will maybe improve in centre midfield, because that he probably hasn't done himself, improved in that area. He's spent money kind of everywhere else but there. If he doesn't, so if Lampard leaves, which could be a possibility if results don't go his way because the money's been thrown at him, is the new manager coming in? I suppose it's all hypothetical, depends who it is. Are they going to see Ross Barkley as a player going forward in the team? Probably not. Not saying that he's not good enough, because he is.
Well, it depends what he does here, really.
Yeah. It's going to be one of them. And I think as well, I think personally, if it works, so if it works for us, then Ross Barkley's got to perform well. We finish relatively well. It may involve him getting into the England team. It may be a case that when he goes back to Chelsea, I don't want to stay, because I'm playing week in, week out for Aston Villa and it's good for my career.
Yeah, I think it'll be another Callum O'Hare kind of scenario where he'll come, hopefully he'll just come here and smash it and be one of the best players and get loads of goals and assists, and then just think, well, I think you can't underestimate the importance of playing week in, week out. And if you're getting that assurance from another team, it's not a Champions League or European club at that time. I mean, God knows what will happen this year. You know, we could easily get into Europe the way we're playing at the moment. If we can sustain it, then, you know, that's another thing. But even if you had the option of going back to a club like Chelsea, I mean, look, Tammy Abraham's done it, but he's keeping the bench warm, or he's kept the bench warm on every game. He hasn't started a game, has he?
It's going to be tough
for European stuff. And, you know, it's important for him to still do that and to still have that as his goal to force his way into the team. But if he does another a whole season of this, you know, just coming on off the bench, then I'm not sure he'll be thinking to himself whether he's made the right decision.
Yeah, it's almost like I feel we're kind of in that position where we really could start pushing on and really start pushing again for that top six. If, you know, if we finish, regardless of where we finish this season, obviously if we don't go down, but we stay up, you know, if it works and, you know, we sign Ross Barkley, that's another big, big signing. You know, if we sign permanently.
I didn't realise how young he was still.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
He's still got years ahead of him. And I think a big aim for him.
Years and years and years.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing with some players, because they come onto the scene at like 16.
Yeah.
And
I
he's,
think maybe because he looks a bit older than his years, maybe. I don't know. But the thing is, though, I don't... If we've got aspirations of getting into Europe this season, which are probably a bit unfounded, really, shouldn't really be going for that. But like, we need to sort out our consistency. You can't be losing 3-0 after beating the champions 7-2.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be losing 3-0 to a team that's just come up. Even no disrespect whatsoever to Leeds, but a team that's just come up, we need to be giving them a game. And we didn't. We just really didn't turn up at all.
Yeah, I think like what you said before about reality check. I don't know whether a bit of complacency came in because we'd won our first four games.
I don't know. I know people were tired. I mean, you know, lots of people have been on international duty and stuff. But
yeah,
you know, let's just hope it was just a blip and we'll beat them next time.
Yeah, well, hopefully, yeah, because I mean, a lot of people have said and we've said it before about we need to make sure we bounce back. It's going to be a tough one against Southampton.
Really tough. It's going to be really good.
They've been decent side and they've got some good players. And you know that with people like Danny Ings, you give them a chance, they'll score.
Goal scorer, yeah. Proper goal scorer. Someone arguably who we should have signed.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. It's one of them. It's sometimes, you know, miss out on these players. I think hopefully going forward because of, I think one thing that potentially last season and possibly start of this season, there's players that we probably wanted and didn't get because people thought we were going to be in a relegation. We may still be in a relegation battle, but people thought, I'm not going to go there because I don't want to be in another relegation battle.
Yeah, for sure.
That'll play something going forward. One thing, obviously, I wanted to talk about was briefly touch on your career. So,
yeah, sure.
So, obviously, you've been an actor for how many years now?
So, I graduated drama school in 2002. So, yeah. Nearly 20 years,
yeah.
coming on for 20 years.
In terms of, so getting into, I imagine, I don't know anything about acting at all.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine obviously different roles that you'll do takes, they're kind of different. So in terms of different time frames. So for example, would you say a bigger role, would it be a case that you may film a number of times a week over a number of months?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so it just depends what the schedule says. So filming schedules are generally devised on the back of locations. So locations are very high, very expensive to hire. So if they've got a building that they've only got for a week, then they'll just try and get as many of your scenes, some of your scenes are in that building, then they'll try and get as many of them in as they can. So you could end up, if they've got one location for a week, you could end up in there every day being flat out. And then the next week you might not be used hardly at all. So, in answer to your question, it depends on where you're shooting, what you've got to do. You know, you could be in every day for 1 week and then only in one day the following week, but it's generally based on where the locations are.
Okay. Would you, is it a kind of Monday to Friday thing, or would you work over a weekend as well? Or again, is it just it can change no matter what? And
generally obviously, Monday to Friday, generally 10 to 12 hour days. You know, you can, because don't forget, you know, your call time on set might be 8 o'clock, but your pickup time, depending on how far away you're living from set, might be 5:30 in the morning. But that's to get you into makeup and costume and make sure you're all ready to shoot at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
But often now they are starting to shoot over weekends because sometimes you can only get the locations at the weekend. Say if you need to shoot in a school, for example, then it might only be available on the weekend.
What kind of impact does your job have on like watching Aston Villa?
Meaning, can I still get to see Villa?
Yeah, it's not just obviously going to Villa Park, because obviously the kind of where you live and stuff like that plays a big part in that. But in terms of just being able to watch us on TV and things like that, does your job often kind of get, no, I don't want to say get in the way, but are you often too busy to be able to watch Villa sometimes, or?
Not necessarily, no, because the games are generally, you know, so Sundays on at 12 o'clock, you know, that's easy to watch, you know, evening games. Sometimes if it's these silly early kickoffs, like 6 o'clock in the evening or something, that, you know, that's a real pain in the neck to try and get. But I bring my laptop with me everywhere, so I can generally get a game if I want to. And I do a lot of filming in Birmingham and stuff anyway, so when I'm up there, it's just a prime excuse to go to the game, you know, when we could.
Because obviously, mentioning Birmingham, one of your roles, so season one of Line of Duty was some of it was based in Birmingham, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually filmed there. So it was filmed in the old Lloyds Bank building, which is Centenary Square. Is that Centenary Square?
Yeah.
The library. So they that was a derelict building, and they built a police station inside it. So
amazing. Obviously, there was part of it as well was the old fire station, wasn't it, on the ring road? Ring road on the island, yeah.
Yeah, so that's where the freezer was with Jackie Laverty's body.
Jackie Laverty, yeah. And obviously, your role as, I think, you were DI Buckles then. I think season four, was that when you became DCI Buckles?
DCI Buckles, yeah.
And I remember you when you, season one, I think you were looking into, was it the money laundering linked to Jackie Laverty?
Yeah,
obviously, I mean, I'm a big Line of Duty fan, so I've seen it time and time again. So was, obviously, you live in London now, obviously, you kind of grew up and lived in Birmingham.
Yeah.
Did you move to London because of your career?
Yeah, so I graduated drama school. I went to drama school in Birmingham School of Speech and Drama, and I graduated there in 2002, and I stayed there for a year or two before I moved to London. But I was travelling down for auditions to London quite often, and then you'd be on the train coming back and you'd get a call from your agent saying they really like you, they want to see you again tomorrow. So I'm like, oh God, you know, I'm on my way back now, so I'd have to get off the train and go down and stay at someone's house. So it was much easier to move down. So, and me and my family, we love it in London, so it's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, because your wife is, she does a similar thing to you, doesn't she? She's an actress.
Yeah, she's an actress as well, and voiceover artist. So so all our work is down in London, but it's changing now. There's less reason to be in London. You know, there's all the auditions at the moment are on Zoom or Skype.
Yeah.
So there's less need to be in London. However, I don't want to move out of it just yet, because
I still
like the buzz and the hustle and bustle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's London for you, isn't it? I suppose the Zoom kind of thing is something that, well, obviously Zoom is not going to go, but in terms of the Zoom, you know, interviews and kind of casting stuff like that, is not going to go on forever, I'd imagine, until it's safer, I suppose. obviously, you've been in.
It's obviously saving a lot of money, because
hiring
studio space for auditions is expensive. But I personally think, you know, it's going to be like this for a while, but I personally think it will get back to meeting people in face to face as much as possible eventually, because the thing about our industry is a lot of it relies on chemistry and how you get on with someone and the right kind of vibes between two actors. So a lot of it relies on that, but who knows?
Yeah, I think that's probably you know, certainly for your industry is pretty key. You know, things like that are going to be a big part, because, you know, people have got to work together for however long. If their chemistry's not there, or, you know, things like that. Obviously, you've been in a lot of roles. There's been, you know, Peep Show, WPC 56, Casualty, Job Lot, Enfield Haunting. Interestingly, I noticed you've played two different roles on Coronation Street.
Yes, true, yeah.
Because I remember you doing the... Was it your first role when you were a lawyer?
Yeah, I was a solicitor for David and Kylie.
Yeah, I remember that one. But then I didn't know about the second one, which was where you sell some dodgy gear.
Yeah, it was kind of so it was with Tyrone and Chesney and that little gang of Rude Mechanicals, you might want to call them. So I was kind of caught up with them and was a bit of a idiot character, knocking off some dodgy t-shirts, I think it was in the end.
Yeah.
But it's great. I love working up there. It's they're all really lovely on Coronation Street. And interestingly enough, they moved premises to Media City a few years ago.
Yeah.
So they used to be based on Deansgate, I think it was. The original studios, ITV studios, are over that way. So I've actually filmed in both those different locations, both those different sets. Yeah.
I mean, what's that like being? Because you know, Coronation Street is iconic, isn't it? It's almost become part of British TV history and present. Yeah. What's it like being part of that?
Yeah, it's amazing when you first go up there, and everyone's really really welcoming and really really friendly. It's like a big family. Which is quite a cliche, but it's actually true up there. They you know, everyone makes a point of coming over to you and introducing themselves and stuff, even if they're not in the scene with you and stuff.
Yeah,
and it's quite interesting to see how it all works. You know, how they do it. You know, they've got this whole kind of street that's been built specifically. You know, and these big studios with a big wall around it. It's a bit like a prison actually. It's got this big 12-foot wall around it.
Yeah.
But it's just really exciting to do, and it's, you know, it's lovely. It's lovely to be working in general.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, you were this time with Alan Partridge, which I think was fairly recent. Was it last year, that one?
Yeah, that was the beginning of last year. I was over in LA for pilot season, having some meetings and stuff out there. And this offer came through. They said, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, big time. So that's a definite bucket list one, that is. And yeah, we had a great time on that. We were improvising a lot with Steve Coogan and stuff. And, you know, he's really cool. And it was brilliant. Really funny. Really, really funny gig.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, yeah, I mean, I'm a big Alan Partridge fan. Steve Coogan is just, you know, he's hilarious. Everything that he's done, he's like next level funny, isn't he? So to have worked with him must have been incredible.
Yeah, it was definitely one of my things that I wanted to do in my career. You know, another one is to work with Ricky Gervais. You know, people like that, these icons that are just geniuses in my eyes.
Yeah.
You know, it was great. And what was interesting was these two brothers were directing it, but they're also the writers of it. So they write with Steve, and they'll sit down in the Winnebago and work out a scene, and they'll write it if they're doing changes to it, for instance. So you could be about to shoot a scene and then all of a sudden they've changed the whole scene and we've got to relearn this scene uber quickly. But then, you know, that's part and parcel of what we do. You know, that's not a problem. But what was really interesting is this is like a completely different scene. I mean, it's still got the same action, but the dialogue was completely different, but it's just as funny, like, yeah. Or even funnier. It's just, you know, these guys are just so good at writing and stuff.
What's it like in terms of, obviously, with the majority of your roles, you are, I imagine, you're having to learn your lines and then go and do your parts. Do your roles kind of massively differ in terms of the amount of time you have to learn your lines and things like that?
It just all depends on when the deal's done and when you're shooting and how much free time you've got. I mean, I always try and learn my stuff as soon as I get it. You know, or at least get familiar with it. So I without fail, I always have a look and figure out how big the job is going to be. Yeah. You know, you get a schedule so you can kind of work out when you're going to be shooting these big scenes and stuff. Or if it's a little scene, you know, you're not too worried about it. But, you know, you can't be too much in your comfort zone because everything's subject to change. And especially with lockdown conditions and stuff like that, you know, think things can change on a sixpence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is it, because obviously, you know, say like, you know, a person like myself, I'll have a job and then I go and apply for a job and then I'll get a phone call about getting it and stuff like that. Do you, with each of your roles, are you still, you know, you're massively excited when you get it and kind of jumping for joy when you get told you've got a part that you really, you know, you really like and that you're really interested in?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's always, it's always a joy to get the good news, because don't forget we go for auditions. That's what we do. So like people with day-to-day jobs might go for an interview once every kind of
Yeah, exactly.
So imagine we're going through interviews every week.
Yeah.
And when you don't get the job, they don't tell you, which is a real tragedy. Really. It's a real shame that they do that. But they're trying to change it now. So they're trying to. There's a hashtag called Yes or No. So actors just want to know yes or no.
Yeah.
Because if you don't get a job that you really want, you know, it hurts. But once you know that you haven't got that, you can forget about it and move on. Whereas if you're constantly waiting for the news and trying to do the maths in your head, well, then they're not shooting for a couple of weeks, so it could happen. You know, it's mentally a bit tough, but you know they're trying to change that now. And I've got a good relationship with my manager and that, and I just you know put a call in and say, look, I'd rather know yes or no.
Really. Yeah. Okay, just to kind of finish, like I mentioned to you before, I've got some quick fire questions, and we tend to kind of fire these at the ex-pros or the current managers, things like that. So some of them I've changed to fit your career, and obviously there's some of them that will kind of that are related to Aston Villa. So we'll have quick fire questions to start with about your career, and we'll end on quick fire questions Aston Villa.
Okay, sure, go.
Okay, best actor or actress that you've worked with?
Lenny James.
See, in my head, I was thinking you're going to say him because I'd seen my dad's, I say quick fire question, totally going off now. My dad's re-watching Line of Duty and he started watching it. And I caught that scene when Lenny James came into you and he was asking you how the investigation was going on.
And he said, don't give it large. Yeah, don't make it too hurt yourself.
And I was just thinking, like, Lenny James, because obviously I'm a big Walking Dead fan, so I've seen Lenny James in Walking Dead and things like that. And I just saw that, and I'm just thinking, like, obviously talking to you, being like this with Lenny James.
Yeah. He's amazing, but in fairness, they all are. I mean, Owen Teal is another big favourite of mine. He's the Guardian of the Watch in Game of Thrones, and he plays DCC Osborne in Line of Duty. He's amazing.
Yeah,
but then look at the rest of them. Adrian Dunbar, Vicky McClure, you know, Martin Compston. They're all high quality actors. Like, you know, Neil Morrissey. He was in the first series.
Yes, right? Neil Morrissey. Yes,
Craig Parkinson. Yeah, you know, Gina McKee. Like massive pedigrees there.
Yeah, I went off then just because I kind of got carried away with. Being fan. Okay, best. This might be a tough one. Best director / writer?
Jed Mercurio, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't direct so much, but he's the showrunner, so he's always on set. He's always about. Absolute genius in every sense of the word, I think.
What about the favourite role you've had?
Favourite role has got to be Buckles in Line of Duty. It's my favourite thing because I mean I've been in it from the start back and forth but it's just good to when you get that audition and sometimes you get the whole episode and this was a pilot, don't forget, this has not been done before, so reading that episode and that character, and I said to my wife, I've got to nail this, I really got to get this is amazing. And I said, I read her that. And she did. And she read the first couple of scenes and stuff. She said, yeah, this is something. This is like something that's not been done before. So,
yeah,
you know.
Amazing. What about the kind of the funniest person that you've worked with in terms of maybe like the kind of the best kind of banter you may have had with someone on a set?
There's always loads of banter knocking about. AD Dunbar is really funny. Sarah Vicky and Martin, Patrick Baladi, yes. He played Jimmy Lakewell. So I ran into him a few times in Series 4. He's just crazy, really, really good guy. Neil Morrissey, great fun, really, really good crack. Yeah,
I bet there's a few of them. What about? I mean, again, this is kind of one that I've adapted for you. Do you have like a kind of best friend that you might have in acting? I suppose it's different because of it's tough for doing kind of different roles and stuff like that. But is there someone that you often speak to or have worked with quite a lot possibly?
Yeah, I've got loads. Like the beauty of this job is that you meet people and you form friendships quite quickly because you kind of have to. You have to get to know each other quite quickly as an actor, especially if you're doing scenes together and stuff. But obviously, most actors are quite extrovert and quite chatty and friendly anyway. So one of my favorite things about this job in general and this industry in general is the people that you meet along the way are just amazing. So some of my best friends are all actors at the moment, and I speak to them all regularly. All the time, you know, it's and I know that I'm going to keep meeting new people and forming new friendships, and that it's quite a joy to of an industry to be in at times.
Cool. And then final one in terms of the kind of quick fire career questions. One kind of downside or negative about your career?
About my career in general?
Not in terms of like your career. I mean, in terms of, I suppose, the industry that you're working in.
So the industry is, I mean, it's very precarious, as you can imagine. So the times are tough when you've gone for jobs and you've not got them. And these jobs could have solved a hell of a lot of issues for you. And then all of a sudden, if you find out you didn't get it, you know, it's quite tough because you can't, it's difficult to see a light at the end of the tunnel because you don't know when you're going to work again, but then something always does turn up. But I've spent a lot of time out of work in some respects, but then I'm always doing voiceovers or a commercial or a foreign commercial, or, and then something else happens. So it's a bit worrying with COVID and that, but you know, it's difficult to see a way out of the recession for theatres and stuff. Cause don't forget, we've got all these theatres that have closed now and all those, you know, it's always been a saturated industry with actors. So imagine it now with all the theatres closed. It's even worse because all the theatre actors are looking for TV work and stuff now. It's just the main downside, I think, would be the uncertainty and but then, you know, when you get jobs and you're working, you feel great.
You know, exactly.
Then you can afford to take a bit of time off and spend time with the family.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to quickfire Aston Villa questions. So you've already said your favourite player. So what about your favourite ever manager?
Favourite manager? Ron Atkinson was a bit of a one. And I suppose Dean Smith is definitely high up on the list at the moment. Obviously, I had a lot of time for Graham Taylor. Bless him. I mean, would these be Villa managers or any managers?
Well, I was thinking Aston Villa, but I mean, go ahead if you think of other managers as well.
I just wish I'd have seen more of Brian Clough. I think Brian Clough was kind of special. I don't think me and you have probably seen a better manager in our lifetime than Alex Ferguson.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But yeah, in terms of Villa managers, I think Dean Smith and Ron Atkinson. And John Gregory, you can't miss out John Gregory, can you?
Yeah, John Gregory was I liked him, as I think sometimes the personality of the manager in terms of how they come across in press conferences and just how they are, and I suppose the way they are with the fans as well plays a big part on how we feel towards them. There's a lot of time when the whole kind of chant the names and give us a wave and things like that. And I always liked John Gregory. He did a decent job as well. Probably could have done it better, but he started pretty well. And I think he had that good rapport with the fans and everything. He came across pretty well.
Yeah, he was great. Ron Atkinson, big personality, easy to be attracted to big personalities, but you know, he was successful for us as well. I don't want to talk too much about Martin O'Neill because I think, you know, it was great when it was there, but he spent a hell of a lot of money, and I don't think, you know, even now, I think we're struggling to recover from it.
You know? I feel that because one thing that was mentioned a few weeks ago, I think it was just before the deadline day, the second kind of deadline day, there was talk about not stockpiling players. Mm. And when I hear that term, I always go back to Martin O'Neill, because at times he'd have three right backs on the bench. You'd have, you know, four centre midfielders that weren't
paying 50 grand or 45 grand a week, not even kicking a ball. You know, it was horrendous, really. But like, I mean, so if you want to be successful, you want to challenge for Europe and stuff, you do need two teams, don't you? You need cover in every single position, and I guess that's what he was doing. Whether it's the right way and spending that kind of money on those kind of players. I don't know, but I think he got found out at Sunderland, and you know, I just don't think it. And walking out on us the week before the season started was tough to take.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I don't think any Villa fan can kind of argue that he didn't do it. You know, that he didn't do a good job, because he did. You know, three top six finishes in a row, but it was just that. There's always going to be that bad taste because of the way he left.
Yeah.
And I think as well, the money that he spent, especially considering the kind of times that we went through, especially, I suppose, the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, Paul Lambert was scratching around League One and League Two for players a lot of the time. And I think that kind of was off the back of all the money that Martin O'Neill kind of spent on players that never really played, in all fairness.
Yeah, but then the ones that did play were great, weren't they? I mean, that midfield of, you know, Petrov and Barry and James Milner and Stuart Downing even was great for us. You know, it was great. Really good.
You've mentioned this previously, possibly. Favourite goal or game?
I don't know if I've got a favourite game. Actually, I probably have. So favourite goal I mentioned to you earlier was, before we started recording, was probably Gary Cahill's overhead kick against the Blues to take us in 3-1. But also, I love Jack Grealish's one against, was it Sheffield Wednesday or Sheffield United, where he made it up in our own half.
It was Rotherham away, wasn't it?
It was Rotherham, of course it was. And dragged the ball back and flicked it with the same foot and then received it again, brought it all the way to the edge of the box, passed it to Elmo. Elmo cut it straight back to him and he just scored it. I mean, that was just total football. It was incredible.
Think,
yeah, John McGinn's. It was John McGinn's. It was against Sheffield United, wasn't it? Or Sheffield Wednesday.
Sheffield
Wednesday, when the underside of the crossbar. I was in the whole team for that as well. That was brilliant. And one of my favourite away games was under Martin O'Neill, actually, when Everton battered us. They absolutely battered us, and Pienaar down the left just tore us a new one. I think they were 2-1 up, and then we got it back to 2-2. But it was all Everton. It was all Everton. And then from the kickoff, Ashley Young took it, and he nutmegged Jolyon Lescott, I think, and give it to Gabby, and he scored, and we won the game in the last minute.
Yeah, because I think they equalised like 90th minute, and then we scored like 92nd, 93rd minute to win.
Oh, was it them that equalised?
Yeah.
Okay. It's difficult to remember after about.
Yeah, I know.
Months of Heineken.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I may be wrong, but yeah, I'm sure that's what it was. I'm sure they equalised late on, and it was kind of like.
But they battered us. I mean, they were all over us. We did, you know, we didn't deserve anything from that game. And but to win like that, you know, it was just brilliant. Really, really good.
I think that's the thing we have, Nick. Extra quality players can do that, can't they?
Yeah, and that. I mean, that team. That was. I mean, Gabby. That was the best. He was at the pinnacle of his career then.
Yeah,
and he was good. He was really good, and it was just really, really refreshing to be able to hit a ball into space and knowing that no matter where Gabby is, that he's probably going to get it. He hit it into the left-hand corner. And that was what we did. Then cut it back to Ashley Young. Ashley Young's going to put it in the box.
Yeah.
And John Carew's going to get his head on it. What about you? What about any special games for you or goals?
Oh, tough one. I mean, goals. If there's been a lot of goals, I think... I remember a goal that I really liked. I think we actually lost the game. We played Spurs at home a number of years ago. And Gareth Barry was playing for us and he was brilliant. And he scored, I think he might have scored an equaliser, I think, late on.
With his right foot, was it?
Yeah, he comes down the left, comes onto his right. And I remember that goal. I remember being there and I remember watching it. And I was like, what a goal. And he all game, he was brilliant. He kind of dragged us through the game.
Yeah. Massively underrated.
People ask me, my favourite Aston Villa player of all time, I usually say Barry, just because he was just a kind of he. I don't think I can remember him ever dropping below a 7 out of 10.
He got man of the match pretty much every game, one season, I think.
Yeah, most games. A lot of games. Yeah. He was 8, 9, 10. You know, every week when he was fantastic.
But that position as well, people who don't understand football don't really see what's going on in that kind of position, that holding kind of central midfield position. Because you don't see what people do because they don't tend to venture forward that much.
Yeah.
You know, their job is to keep the ball moving and to not lose it. And he never did that. He never did that. And it makes me laugh actually because we used to call him Gareth Batty because he had a big backside, we used to think, and he used to when the player would come, he'd just turn his back. And be able to muscle the player off. And if you watch John McGinn, he does a similar thing. He's got that low centre of gravity. But when he can see the danger coming, he just gets down and sticks his bum out. You can't get the ball off him. And it's great. It's great to watch.
Yeah, but Barry was one of them. He almost had everything in terms of... He probably was a bit slow, but he read the game well. He was a good passer. Obviously, he could shoot. Great at penalties. He was good in the air as well. Yeah. He was strong. And he was when that move from left back to centre midfield was fantastic.
Yeah, he understood the game as well. He understood where to be, where he should be a lot of the time, and he just didn't venture away from that. He was just really solid. I really liked him.
Final one. Your favourite Aston Villa shirt?
Got to be the Luke one. Got to be the Luke one.
Yeah.
And I'm gutted because I haven't got one of them. I've got the away one. I managed to get the away one, but the home one I just thought was so special. Yeah, really, really.
Yeah. It was just everything about it. I think people obviously liked it. It was a Villa fan who designed it, but it was a, you know, a great kit as well.
I've got a lot of Luke stuff, but you know, my mate used to run his shop. I think it's his nephew Matt. And Matt Roper, and I worked with him years ago when I used to work at Reese. I used to work at Reese in the Bull Ring, and earlier on when it was at New Street and stuff. So I knew a lot of the retailers and stuff. Yeah. So I was getting the Luke stuff early on. I've got quite a few of the tops and that in my wardrobe. So when he got that gig, it was just brilliant. You know, a Villa fan designing the Villa kits, and then no one expected it to be as good as it was.
Yeah.
No one could have believed how good it. I think we'd have all liked it just basically for romantic reasons that it was a Villa fan designing it. So it was always going to be a winner. But when we seen it, it was absolutely outstanding, and the quality of the kit and everything. I'm just gutted I didn't get a home one.
Yeah. No, I'm same. I mean, I've got a few behind me, but I haven't got the Luke one, which is a bit of a shame. It's a great kit, and as well that season you had what. Villa fan as manager, Villa fan as captain, Villa fan who designed the kit. It just all came together brilliantly, didn't it?
Exactly that. It was all meant to be, wasn't it? It was brilliant. And I'm glad he's still designing stuff for us, but I hope they give him another contract at some point.
Hopefully. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, he's loves Aston Villa, and there's that connection's there. So hopefully something will happen going forward.
And not only that, I've met him a few times now, Luke. I've been in his box actually for a drink with him, and he's probably one of the nicest guys I've ever met at Villa Park.
Yeah, quite a few people have said that. To be fair, I mean, I've never met the bloke, but a lot of people have said how nice he is. So
he's as genuine as they come. He's the salt of the earth, that kind of person, and that's the kind of people you want involved with the club. I think he's great. He's a really nice guy.
Exactly. Well, massive, massive thanks for agreeing to come on. Absolute pleasure, obviously, speaking to you as a Villa fan, and obviously, a fan of yours from, the roles that you've been in betweeners and line of duty. I know the in betweeners are a small role, but it's always one that I remember.
It's great. And because it was a pilot, none of us realised how big it was going to be, but because it was a pilot and it done really well, it's great because I still get the royalty checks every year.
There you go.
Always works.
Ideal. But yeah, massive thanks. Obviously,
you're welcome
anytime to join us. We tend to do a post-match podcast after the games. Because of having kids, we tend to do it you know, 8, 9 o'clock or whatever, it depends on what time the game's on, but say the one on Sunday will probably be about 8 o'clock or whatever. So if you want to join us, you're more than welcome.
Yeah, George, well, keep in touch, and hopefully we'll get to see each other down at Villa Park at some point.
Yeah, where do you go? Hopefully it'll be soon. I'm usually in the Trinity, so.
Okay. I found some vouchers that came with my season ticket today, like little £5 vouchers. So I don't know if they'll work.
Yeah, I have to try them out. See if you can use them. But yeah, I'll keep in touch, and absolute pleasure to have you on. Get in touch whenever you want. Come on the pod whenever you want, and yeah, would be great. Hopefully, we'll see you down Villa Park, but I'll probably see you on my screen sometime soon.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. Depending on what happens with COVID, but yeah, massive, massive thanks. And everyone listening, make sure you follow Nigel on Twitter. He's a massive Villa fan, so he's always getting involved in everything, talking about Villa. At Villa Boise.
Yeah, Boise is my nickname. So at Villa Boise.
Yeah, at Villa Boise. Follow him, get involved. Obviously, a big Villa fan. Subscribe to the channel as well, and you may see Nigel on some future pods, hopefully. But massive thanks to everyone with Villa Together. Thank you very much.